Well, what a pleasure it is to have Malcolm here. When I first went to the Mystics and Scientists in 1981, Malcolm was presiding over the conference, and I remember in, I think, quite a colourful, maybe even Klimt-like sweater. you had multicoloured sweaters, and occasionally you had a cravat as well, I think, occasionally.
Yeah. Oh,
you?
Yes, I didn't wear ties in
No, I think it was a cravat. No, exactly. And so he was the orchestrator of these conferences originally, the creator of the conferences. And as he said last night, the fact that he came to arrange these conferences was a personal journey for him, and the origins of the conference equally was part of that journey. And so I'm really pleased that he's able to be with us this afternoon to share something of his own journey, which I think will have resonance with many people here. So, Malcolm, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, some of this is going to be a bit controversial, and I would like you to, check at saying, what's he talking about? This is all nonsense. I would invite you to suspend that and wait to see what happens. Well, it all started about 42 years ago. I was driving down the West Coast Highway in California to the Esalen Institute, a growth center. And that growth center was in Esalen. Yeah, it was in Esalen, yeah, that's right. Now, previously I'd been a director of a company making furniture and living in a cute house in the center of Hampstead. At that time, the village was serious. A lot of very serious people there. It was arty, it was bohemian, and intellectual. It was an exciting place to be. Now, this controversial bit. Drugs were taken seriously and with care by grown-ups in small groups who were interested in exploring altered states of consciousness and their psyches. A very different generation to the ones that followed, who used and abused them for recreational purposes. We were doing something of an entirely different order. So it was during this time that I twice took lysergic acid, LSD, and entered into ecstatic states, both visual and mental. Somehow, after those two trips, it lodged in my consciousness that I was allowed only one more experience of this sort. And it was an experience that was only allowed under certain very specific conditions. So the conditions were these. It had to be pure Sandoz acid. I had to be physically clean at the time and wearing freshly laundered white clothes. It had to be in a place of outstanding beauty with somebody non-judgmental who could look after me in case I did anything stupid, and would come with me if I wanted to interact with other people. How I knew this, I can't explain to you, but I knew that those were the conditions. And these conditions were most unlikely to come together, particularly as American drug laws had made LSD illegal and stopped Sandoz distributing it. except to qualified and licensed psychiatrists for research purposes. Anyway, several months later, a friend of mine who had taken a house at Esalen, at the Esalen Growth Center in California, and knowing my interest in the human potential movement and encounter groups, called me up and invited me to come and stay with him there. And so I went. And I found myself driving down the beautiful and almost empty Pacific Coast Highway. And somewhere just before Carmel, my car broke down. No mobile phones in those days. So I sat on the bonnet and waited for a kindly motorist to talk to me, to take me to a garage where I could contact the rental company. And thus began a series of experiences, a series of coincidences that would completely change my life. A white Volkswagen van drew up. And the driver asked, "Can I help you?" Very kind. It turned out that the driver was Stan Groff. And he was lecturer at that time. He was lecturer in residence at Esalen, my destination. And get this, he was also a licensed researcher into the use of LSD. And it's use of LSD and its effects on the psyche and its uses as a therapeutic tool. And later, as some of you will know, I've heard from the chuckles, he was to become a major figure in his field and founding president and chief theoretician of the International Transpersonal Association. He did a lifetime's work in consciousness research. And I was to meet him several years later, and maybe I'll come to that. We'll see. Just then, the important thing was that he had Sandoz acid, lived in a place of outstanding beauty, and would introduce me to a nice, reliable woman who had a teepee on the ancient burial grounds of the Esalen Indians and on the cliffs above the Pacific. What better could I would met the conditions under which I could take this final trip? And so it was through this extraordinary set of coincidences that the final chemical exploration of my consciousness came together. When the acid started to kick in, it catalyzed the final stage of the purification process. Remember, at that time, I was absolutely clean on the outside, but now I had to go through the experience of cleaning out my insides. Didn't know that was going to happen. And so with my bowels about to open, I left the teepee and squatted on the cliffs and emptied myself. And this was no ordinary going to the toilet. And it was in harmony with the rhythmic sound of the ocean crashing against the cliffs. Whoosh, 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 more, whoosh. And that went on until I was completely empty. All my intestines, all my bowels, there was nothing left. And it was then that I was in the state of purification for what was going to follow, which was amazing. So there actually followed 2 hours of spiritual teaching. Which I haven't got time for, is 2 hours. Anyway, the final thing that I was told was that the function of a lover, the male lover anyway, in this case, but it could be any lover, woman or man, the function of the lover was to prepare themselves as a mirror so that when... And also keep that mirror so clean that when their beloved looked at them, their beloved would understand themselves more deeply. Needless to say, that while I recognized later that this cleansing of one's mirror would cut out the projections that bedevil close relationships, I knew that such selflessness was beyond me. Though I did find out how to become a mirror for my students on the Transformational Journey workshops, which I ran for many years. Anyway, sharing these experiences, Gough was very interested in what was going to happen to me. So I shared these experiences with him just the following day. And I asked if there was anyone in England from whom I might learn more spiritual knowledge. He answered that he'd heard about a group of people around a man called Sir George Trevelyan. And he thought, he might be interesting, I don't know much about him. Oh, I'd like to meet him, I said. And returning to the UK, forgot all about it. Now, be careful what you wish for and what you pray for, particularly and probably only when your ego is out of the way. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. Just go ahead and go and do your praying. And mine certainly was, as I was still coming down from an altered state of consciousness, and I was completely clean. So I went back to England, and guess what happens? I encounter a series of life-changing experiences. The woman who was living with me moved on with her 2 young children, who I cared for, and a business in which I'd invested most of my capital went bust. And there was no way I could continue with my current lifestyle or my image of myself, who I thought I was. In short, my personality was entirely inadequate to deal with the situation in which I found myself. And if I were to survive, that personality had to be redesigned. That is, if I didn't kill myself first, which at the time seemed to be a very reasonable option. So I started, or more accurately, my mind started coming up with new personality models and rejecting them just as quickly and working faster and faster to find one that might be acceptable. And soon the process, and I'm particularly interested in how you're going to deal, explain this to me. So soon, anyway, my mind was working faster and faster and faster. 5 times as fast, 10 times as fast, 20 times as fast, 50 times as fast. And it speeded up to such an extent, I knew I was going to come mad. My sense of survival led me with the greatest difficulty to a friend I knew who had some powerful tranquilizers. Difficult because this change in brain function had also changed my sense of visual perception. Streets in London, which I'd known since boyhood, suddenly became different. I no longer really knew where I was. I was uncertain, insecure, and very frightened. The reason I was lost was I was perceiving different aspects of the same streets that I'd been walking down since I was a young boy. Where before my markers may have been a red front door or a green gate or a crack in the pavement here, a particular tree, oh, I've lost the plate. So my eyes now fell on another series of new markers. A particular bush in a front garden, a clay-tiled roof with a cement cat running across it, a black car in a driveway, things that I'd never seen before. I finally made it to my friend's house, just. And at last, with the tranquilizers swallowed, my mind started to slow down. And over the weeks and months, I slowly adjusted a little to my new situation. Well, by then, I was no longer living, could no longer afford to live in a charming house in Hampstead, but was living in a squatted house. I'd come down to that. I'd been reduced to that. I was living in a squat. And that's another story. Be careful what you wish for. That's a sort of phrase that you hear, but you don't often hear the results of what can happen when you wish for something, only when you're in an altered state. So don't worry. Normally, oh, I'd like so-and-so. Don't worry about it. It won't ever happen. Or if you will, if it does, it's extremely unlikely anyway. And it was in that squat that somebody said to me one day, there's a man called Sir George Trevelyan lecturing tomorrow at St. John's in Smith Square. You might be interested. And still the name meant nothing to me. But as I had nothing else to do, I went along and watched in amazement as an elderly and eccentric man with flowing white hair, climbed onto the platform and talked about the excitement of a new age. There wasn't anything exciting in my life at that time, so I listened. And at the interval, We all trooped downstairs into the crypt for tea and cakes. And unwittingly, I sat next to Lady Raeburn and Sir John Sinclair, both of whom I got to know later, who were also good friends of Sir George Trevelyan. Sir George came down and walked towards us, and ignoring his friends, stopped right in front of me and said, of all things, "It's nice when we meet." "What are you doing tomorrow?" I said. He said, "Yeah." "Meeting you," I said. One thing led to another. We met at his cottage in Shropshire, discovered we both had a love of poetry, shared our interest in Eliot's Four Quartets, and he asked me to come and help out at Wrekin Trust. The Trust at that time had a house in a village nearby, which was used for administration. And I could live and work there. At least it was better than the squat. George asked me for references. This is so amusing. I gave him Sir William Perring, who was Lord Mayor of London, and Sir Paul Riley, Director of the Council of Industrial Design, both of whom I knew well. With such referees, he never bothered to contact them. And it was to be 2 years before I remembered the wish I'd expressed to Stangroff that I'd like to meet Sir George Trevelyan. A wish that could only have been fulfilled by the complete destruction of the interesting and privileged materialistic life I'd been leading. And that was the start of things. You'd think it would be the end. It's not just the beginning. I was sitting in a lecture hall. Oh, yes. Shortly afterwards, while I was helping out at a Wrekin conference on health and healing, I was sitting in the lecture hall listening to a talk by the famous healer Harry Edwards. And he was saying that everybody had energy in their hands and invited the audience to put their hands like this and move them about. And he said, almost everybody will feel a tingle in their fingertips. Try it. Come on. Try it. Put your hands like this and concentrate on your fingertips and move them backwards and forwards and see if anything happens. Remember Macbeth's witches? "By the pricking of my thumbs, something evil this way comes." Anyway, so I did, and I felt not only a tingle, but also saw a shimmering lines of light connecting my fingertips. And it seemed that that energy went into my body and suddenly exploded from the base of my spine, shot up to my head, went into my body, shot up my head and burst out of my crown, and I was flaming like a Roman candle. It was as if my life force was draining away, and I knew with absolute clarity that unless it soon stopped, I would die. The person sitting next to me was concerned and pointed out Bruce McManaway, who I'm sure some of you still remember. He was a renowned healer himself, and he was chairing the conference. And she told me to grab him and tell him I needed help. And I did it with such energy that he immediately took me into a nearby room and told me I was having a Kundalini experience. He told me to beware of stimulation and place my hands above my head and gently move it up and down to slow down the energy. And he manipulated my spine because he said one of the reasons it was so violent was that there were blockages in my spine and that would cause the energy to build up to such a degree that it burst right out. And it was indeed very dangerous. Later, I would read a book by a man called Gopi Krishna, who had a similar experience, albeit within the framework of meditational practice. And he recounts how he traveled India, trying to find gurus who could help him control the energy. You've read that book?
Yes,
sir. Yes. It's quite a long time ago, the book, so probably have to be old like us before you, otherwise you wouldn't have heard of it. And he recounts how he travelled India trying to find gurus who would help him control the energy. And although they knew about it from older writings, none of them had actually experienced it. And he had to find out how to deal with it himself after a lot of difficulties. Later, he would define it as a chaotic and spontaneous religious experience. Now, I looked up Gopi Krishna and Kundalini on the internet, and I found that it was around this time, this particular time, that suddenly two or three books had come out about it. Before, there was nothing, or nothing indeed that was recorded on Google. And I saw that there suddenly, around this time, very few people, were beginning to have that experience. Now, of course, I expect you can go to a weekend workshop called the Kundalini Experience, and they would promise you how to raise your Kundalini, and you might indeed think that that is what has happened. You could also go to a workshop which would be called a 24-hour enlightenment experience, as if you could become enlightened in 24 hours. In my case, it manifested also in seeing the ground moving and for a while being able to see in the dark. It was as if my brain had become rewired and new neural pathways connected. I felt my consciousness move from the back of my head, limbic system, to the crown, and then down to the middle of my forehead, where it stayed. And it was accompanied by a marked increase in intelligence and understanding. Didn't stop there. Shortly afterwards, in that little, not very nice house, well, I didn't like it anyway, in Bomere Heath, but as I said, it was better than the squat, I had a course of dream instruction. And it lasted for about 2 months, and it took a strange form. Night after night, I was given old manuscripts to read, written in what seemed to be a dead language, a dead Eastern language. And I'd wake in the morning knowing stuff that I didn't know the night before. At that time, George Reakin Trust was offering courses by knowledgeable people covering different areas of spiritual knowledge, set up by Sir George Trevelyan before we met. I would go and help out on the courses because I wanted to learn as much as I could, and found out that I already knew what most of the lecturers were talking about. That was because of the dream instruction. And as the dream teaching continued, it got even weirder. I not only knew what the lecturers were talking about, but I also knew what they didn't know. It was very odd. So let's move on. I was trying to give up smoking at the time, cutting cigarettes in half, smoking one less every day. Didn't work. No success. And most people who've gone through this experience found it doesn't work either. Now, George has set up a pilgrimage to sacred sites in Cornwall. Thin places, powerful places, churches built over underground streams, perhaps on ley lines. And in one small church, I don't remember now where it was, he'd arranged a morning of poetry and music. And I chose to read from the lectern a very powerful passage from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, East Coker. And I hope you'll bear with me while I read it, because it contains some very powerful stuff. Now, I meant to bring down the book with me, and what is written down here is not exactly what he says, but it's near enough. There's one or two lines different. "You say I'm repeating something I've said before." This is what I was reading. "You say I am repeating something that I've said before. Shall I say it again? Shall I say it again? I shall say it again. In order to arrive there, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive what you do not know, you must go by a way that is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And the only thing you know is what you do not know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not." And during this reading, I felt a powerful energy coming, as it were, from above. As it were, into my crown and emerging through my voice, which I supposed was the throat chakra. And I could see people in the church flinching with the power of the words. Thoroughly shaken, I myself left the church and walked around trying to ground myself. When suddenly, out of the blue, a huge voice of indescribable and awesome power said to me, "You will stop smoking. And I was terrified. Thereafter, there was no way I could ever light another cigarette, which I haven't until even up to now. As time went by, I grew very thankful that I was only told to stop smoking. Suppose it had said, no more sex, or give away the small amount of capital you've left to the poor and become an itinerant monk. Whatever it had said, I would have had to do. Up to this time, guidance that I'd received and would continue to receive, where am I? Oh yes, guidance I said would continue to receive all the time I was doing the work came in such a way, it floated like gossamer into my mind, and it came in such a way as if I could brush it aside quite easily. Or follow it without any coercion. It was entirely an exercise in free will. And this happened many times. Classic example of how we're given free will. Anyway, this experience, this huge voice, was of an entirely different order. And I shared it with the Kabbalist Warren Kenton, Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, who actually I introduced, David asked me to introduce at the 24th Mystics and Scientists Conference. And he told me it was a direct transmission down the center of the schematic tree of life, which is a different way of sharing the tree of life that we recently saw up on the screen. It's a schematic scheme. If any of you are interested, you can find out about how that works. And he said it went right down the middle. Now, perhaps I should also add at this stage that the words I read you from T.S. Eliot, I have experienced all of them. That's pretty shattering. And Eliot knew what he was talking about. Doing well. I could have done more. So I'm going to finish with perhaps the purest experience that I could describe as being mystical. I'd gone to the Sinai Desert to meet a Bedouin and search some sites to set up camps for a small group who had come there to learn about experience, the power of silence, and experience being in a place of perfect peace and little stimulation to do some spiritual work. A quality of silence in which people could experience themselves more deeply. He would bring a couple of camels and meet me at a certain wadi. He came eventually, much to my relief, because I'd been dropped in a place where there wasn't any traffic. And if he hadn't come, I probably would have died. Anyway, he came. And we spent 3 days on camels, sorting out different sites in the Sinai, and stopping by the odd Bedouin tent for hospitality, or for tea, or a meal, or perhaps somewhere nearby to sleep. It was one of the happiest times of my life. free from stimulation and full of silence. He left me at the Jebel Musa, the Moses Mountain, where it is claimed that Moses received the Ten Commandments, which the group would climb, and which I would now do alone as part of research for the trip. By the time I got there, it was hot. I left my clothes at the bottom and started to climb, not by the winding paths going round and round, but more directly because time was short. As I climbed, I became anxious and frightened. I was getting colder, and it was more difficult to find my way, and the air was thinner, all conditions that would push my usual sense of self out of the way. Finally, I reached the top, and out of breath, I sat down and looked at the amazing landscape of mountains and beauty spread all around me. And suddenly, what I can only describe as the peace of the Lord descended on me, and I knew I was cared for and loved, and everything was all right in my world. Perhaps I should emphasize that none of these experiences were sought for or were the result of spiritual work of a traditional nature. There's all sorts of other things happened, and some of them are actually even more important than I've told you about, but we don't have very much time left. And anyway, I haven't written them and sorted them all out, but it's given me a huge kick up the backside to get on and write the whole story and do a book, somehow do a book on it. Whether I'm 85 years old and whether I shall live long enough to finish it, I don't know, but we shall see. So I think that's it. I've told you that none of it I was sought for. None of it was a result of spiritual work. It wasn't a result of meditation. There are many paths to spiritual knowledge, it is said, and only one way. So that is my particular path. That's what happened to me. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Malcolm, that journey. We've got a few minutes if anybody would have any reflections or questions.
Great talk. Thank you for sharing that. I was wondering, looking back, how important do you think LSD was for your spiritual progression?
I think it was very important. Shamans used hallucinogenics to get going. They also used them probably throughout their lives. I was very fortunate that I only needed to do it three times, and I was already interested in exploring my psyche and getting to know myself better. So fortunately, it was only three times, and it was long enough. It was enough times.
Just to follow up on the previous question, could you elaborate a little on, because you mentioned the third trip, the circumstances, and then you came back to Britain, and I wasn't clear what had happened or what had you had seen or experienced that precipitated the crisis back in Britain.
Oh yes, well, the business in which I'd invested a lot of money and put a personal guarantee in, went bust. I found that there was a dishonest director, and I was liable for all the debts. No, except for the fact, I suppose, that I went off to Esalen and followed the, and followed that, but nothing else.
Thank you for those revelations about yourself. I just have to say I'm not comfortable at all about using drugs for spiritual development. If you think of shamans, they're using it alongside their spiritual development. They're using it alongside their spiritual development. Their inner spiritual.
Could you talk up a bit? I'm a bit
better. Yeah. Is that better?
That's very good.
I beg your pardon. I'm not comfortable with using drugs for spiritual development. I think we need to earn those levels of accessing that spiritual development, and we earn it, and it's safe to do so. When we go into different realms, we have gatekeepers on the other side that actually help us to stay safe. And when you take drugs, you break the boundaries of your crown, your aura, the mental patterns, and it's very hard to bring those back into alignment, to contain your energy again. So any overstimulation is really hard sometimes. So I think it is a bit dangerous for some.
Oh, you're completely right. I agree with you absolutely.
And I wouldn't advocate it.
No, nor would I.
Okay, I just wanted to make that clear.
However, in my case, it brought huge... it had huge results. 15 years work with Rican Trust, the founding of Mystics and Scientists, but I wouldn't advocate it for anybody else. It happened to me, and that was my experience, and I did manage to integrate it extremely well.
Hello. Firstly, thanks for being so honest. There's not many people in this room that would be that honest, and I really appreciate your frankness. I just wondered, on reflection, being 85 and looking back, do you think that, or I wonder whether you'd reflected on it at all, do you think that would have happened without LSD? Or I appreciate that was your path. Rightly or wrongly, you know, I'm certainly not judging you for that path you took. But I wonder whether you feel that that was would have happened anyway. Do you have any feelings on that?
No, I don't. I don't think it would have happened anyway. I think I must have been near the edge. So that, I mean, three trips of LSD is nothing. I mean, there's kids take LSD maybe 40 times, 50 times. It was just enough for me.
Do you think previously to taking the LSD, because you seem to know that that was something you were meant to do?
No, I think I did it because I had a serious group of serious, mature friends, it was at the very beginning. I suppose Ram Dass, Alpert, and that lot were doing stuff in America, and they'd been interested, and we were all interested in finding out about ourselves. The point is that the motive was in exploring our psyches, and what really counts is the motive.
Thank you, appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. It takes a bold soul to over here to say what you said, and many wouldn't. I'd just like to take up one point with you. There was a sense running through what you were saying that this somehow came from an unexpected source or some kind of other entity. Now, I don't know, and I don't want to judge what it was, because obviously we can't look into your mind about that, but there are many, many accounts of this type of experience, and the general impression that I get is that these, particularly when they're regenerative, if you like, they move a person forward. I think I would talk exclusively about that, and yours seem to be that kind of thing. It's the soul speaking. It's your own soul that's doing it. And the reason why I mention that is because of something that you said, which was about this principle of free will. And I think it's well known again in your circles, and Sir George would certainly have said it, that free will is an absolute, and the masters don't depart from that. They can't suddenly wave a magic wand and force humanity into anything. It's done through the soul in contact with these deeper influences. So, and so I'm not trying to be slow about this, but do you get the impression it seemed very much like your soul speaking and doing it, and it was far more personal than you think. I just wondered if you've got anything to say about that.
Well, yes. I don't know. It doesn't feel like my soul, but on the other hand, I don't think I know much about my soul. I find it difficult to think that my soul would have spoken quite like that. But on the other hand, I wanted to stop smoking. I really wanted to stop smoking. I suppose it could have been any part of my psyche, but fortunately, it's the only time in my life that I experienced that sort of power. And I always saw sort of like St. Paul on the road when he gets hit. It was absolutely devastating. So I didn't feel it was internal. It felt external. And I was absolutely terrified. And I'm glad it never happened again. Thank you for asking.
Malcolm, thank you so much for your very excellent description of what happened to you. I have just one or two questions for you. The first one is, it's not unusual in people who have near-death experiences and have a wide experiences like you had, for them to have gifts afterwards.
That to is have
gifts.
Gifts.
They're either telepathic, or they can see energies, or they can see auras, or they're very intuitive. Have you been given any such gifts?
Well, yes and no. While I was working for the 14, 15 years I worked at the Rican Trust, I had a continuous flow of information that I needed. I could always find answers, and I could always find directions to go. And while I was doing the Transformational Journey workshops, which was for about 12 years, I was gifted by being able to... I had answers which I had not really thought out, which was able to mirror back to people the truth of what they were saying and provide answers for them. And that was a series of workshops which went on, I don't know, 14, 15 years. And then after I left the Trust, even more advanced work. So hugely developed intuition. I got inner teaching as a result.
And do you think now that you're 85 that you have completed your life's work, or do you feel that there are more experiences yet to come?
Now it's sort of interesting. It's got interesting. When I stopped at Rican Trust, when I retired, I was pushed a bit. And unfortunately, Rican Trust was never quite the same after I left. So when I stopped, I did what I told my students to do after every workshop. I said, be ordinary. The moment you start thinking about yourself as being special, you'll get into a mess. So leave this workshop and stay ordinary. And so when I left Rican Trust, I followed my own advice and stayed ordinary. And I've stayed ordinary for over 30 years, 35 years or so. Now, suddenly, another series of coincidences has entered into my life. My son-in-law in Melbourne was researching my life on the internet, my furniture career, my work with Rican Trust. All that I told you about Sir George and I meeting was all reported 8 years ago by Sir George. And it's all there. It's nice when we meet and all that stuff. It really did happen. So, yes, I've been ordinary. It's been ordinary. But suddenly, as a result of my son-in-law doing that and me seeing the advert on the internet for Mystics and Scientists 40, I thought, well, I was always very fond of David. And I remember him as a young man. Did I tell you this? I remember him as a young man. He came up on the platform after some speakers had finished, and I was sitting on the platform. Johan Kwanya of New Humanity had said, would you speak to David Lorimer? He's a friend of mine, and he's written a book on near-death experiences. And David came up to me and said, would I mention his book? So I did to the whole conference, and hopefully they bought a few. Have I lost the plot of your...
It's really whether you feel you've completed...
Suddenly, as a result of me writing that to David, this was only about 6 weeks ago, he shot back an email asking me, because I wrote him and told him how the first conference happened, because there's been a lot of people claiming all sorts of stuff over the years. Responsibility for health and healing for mystics and scientists have been taken by all sorts of groups after I set it up, as I faded from the scene. So I told David that how it was, how it all happened. And so he shot back this thing, would I open the conference? So this was out of the blue. And so I thought, right, I'm going to do that. And then David and I had a Skype in London only a few weeks ago, in my home in Marlborough, only a few weeks ago. And I told him some of this stuff that you've heard. And he said, would you be willing to talk about this? So I thought about it and said, right, I'm 85. Time I spoke about it, because it's time that this sort of knowledge became available. It isn't just by meditation, it isn't just by doing spiritual discipline that people's consciousness can become changed. It's always a dangerous business taking the quick path. The Buddhists know very well that there's two paths, the slow one, which takes about 20 years, and the quick path, which can result in people going mad. Oh, golly. The Dalai Lama heard about my stuff at one stage and invited me to come and see him. And I won't go into what we spoke about, but it was, it also covered the areas of Western people going crazy in Buddhist monasteries by being told to do certain practices which didn't resonate with the European psyche or the British psyche. And I spoke to him about this, and I never forget, he said to me, "It stayed with me all my life, and I thought one day I would write a book." Because he said to me, "Malcolm, even Tibetans go mad."
Well, thank you very much indeed for sharing that all, Malcolm. And it seems to sort of complete a cycle in a sense.
Yes, I think it's going to start another one.
I know. That's so I hope that you know, this has all provided a catalyst for you. And, finish the cycle on a harmonious note.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.